Yeah, so I've got this funny accent because I come from the bottom of the world, and originally at least, and so now I've got this funny mix, and Michael is saying to me that in fact I've now lost the Kiwi accent. So I'm going back to New Zealand for a visit on July 4th, so I'm now going to be in very big trouble, because I'm going to have this twang, this Yankee twang, as they say. Now, we know that Yankee is a bad word if you're a southerner, right? Now, we don't want to start that up here, but we do know there's some history behind this. Okay, so my topic today is readjusted perfection. And so I am a teacher, and I have to admit this. I suppose really it's not a thing that I should be overly proud about, but I do have a love other than the Bible. I do love what I teach, which is statistics. Now that seems really weird, I know, but I do. I enjoy it, and I think about it, and if I don't watch out, I think about various ideas in the Bible in very statistical ways. And I see various Greek words. And, for example, metron, the measure. And I'm thinking of ideas to do with mathematical concepts. And I look at other words. I have a history of studying ancient Greek. So I got a master's degree in ancient Greek language. So I like Greek. And so that's all these ideas, the secular studies that I've done, they kind of impringe a little bit into the area where I'm interested in also, which is the Bible. But as time goes on, I'm increasingly worried about the fact that I haven't put enough time into resourcing what I've come to understand about the Bible. And I would like to leave this earth with some resources that I've accumulated, and so that they can keep going. So we have, I come from a church in Oklahoma where we have this, we support this ministry, which is an internet ministry. It's called rightdivision.com. And on this site, there are all kinds of resources, writings, videotapes, audio tapes, all sorts of things. And what we've found is that it's like a wellspring for those who are already interested. But should that be our target? Should it be that we are only interested in reaching those that are already interested? Wouldn't it be nice if we could put a little bit of salt into the horse's mouth and make them thirsty and then come back for more? That is someone that's perhaps not that interested at the beginning but then gets interested. So we are looking for ways of reaching out to a wider audience. And if you've got ideas, man, we're interested in hearing. And so that's something that we're working on. Okay. So as I say, I am a teacher. And as a foreigner coming into America, I've come in contact with people in Oklahoma who are very much interested in the founding of America. What makes America different? Now, this is not my message. My message is totally about biblical things. But there's an interesting parallel that I can see which will perhaps help you understand what I'm getting at. Especially if you're, as Americans, you're interested in how the country began. And this is important, especially, you know, as Ronnie was saying, if you look at what's going on in the world today, what we really need, politically speaking, are people who are intelligent about how this country began. Because the more they come in contact with how the country began, the better equipped they'll be to face what's going on in the world today and stop what's happening in London repeating here. So the Declaration of Independence is a great document, and I've read it through. And it begins about things concerning truths, which the writer said were self-evident. that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent. Now this is the big part. This is the big part of this. The consent of the governed. What does that mean? Well, we are the governed. And we give consent to being governed. And we are the ones who are in charge. Or should be, right? We, the people, we are supposed to be in charge of this thing. These people that we put in because we give them consent. They're there by our consent. They don't tell us what to do, right? We tell them what to do. Now, as Americans, you're beginning, well, this is nothing new, right? This is something you understand. But unfortunately, many Americans today are not engaged with this at all. The left has basically taken hold of the education. How do I know? Because I brush shoulders with them. Right? So I know that when I enter a campus, generally speaking, in the United States, most of the people who are running the shows will be liberals. Generally speaking. Right? Not all. Not all. But many will be. And the majority will be. And if you look at the history of how things began in the country, there was this great divorcement which occurred. Right? And that was done with much pain. You know? Hang with us or hang separate. There was a great cost and bloodshed. Now, if you were to look at this picture that I've got here, you'd say, well, this is obvious. Yeah, it's obvious only if you have been told and you are taught about how things began and how that a constitution was put in place. And that certainly for us who are Acts 28, is we can see some kind of a parallel here, that there was, you know, in the book of Acts, there was this great divorcement which occurred right at the end, and then a new ministry began. Right? And based upon this, and understanding this, our orientation of truth as Christians has changed. Right? It's changed because of this. You say, no, this is obvious, we all know. No, it's not obvious. No, Christians do not know this. They don't know this. Right? You say, well, they all know this. You know, there's an interesting guy on the internet. What he does is he goes around and interviews Americans, young Americans, and asks them let's not use the word obvious. Ask them questions about these things. They are clueless. Clueless. These are Americans. Why are they clueless? Because they have been raised within the institutions which have been controlled by a certain group of people with a philosophy, with an end game in mind, right? And the news media are a part of it. The news media, not the news media. They are another political group. You know what I mean? We all know this is the case. This is a big influence on what happened in the previous election of the president, right? This became very plain and clear, and is plain and clear that this is going on. And right at the end of the book of Acts, you read about this, and when he said these words, the Jews departed. And upon this, we can see a great divorcement which occurred. If you look at perfection, this idea, let's just come at this from a very general point of view. To be a perfected American, what would you need? Well, one thing is, you certainly need education. You need education, and the education would involve understanding a readjustment that occurred, right? You're not going to try and perfect your life and run your life as an American based upon the rules of King George and his Britain, right? No way. No way. So you're going to have to understand that there was a readjustment of things that occurred. And then what are you going to do? You're going to learn the responsibilities and the privileges of liberty under the Constitution of the United States. That's what you're going to do to be a perfected American. But the idea that you could somehow be a perfected American based upon someone else's government is ridiculous. It would be ridiculous, would it not, for me to bring up perhaps the rules and the government responsibilities of Germany and then say to you as an American, now based upon these rules, this is how you're going to live your life in America. That's a no. That is a big no. You're not going to do that. You're going to first of all accept that there has been this readjustment that occurred, and man, at a great cost. And this is one of the most annoying things to me about living in this age, is that people do not respect the cost that went in to the liberty that we just spit on. You think about what's going on around the world today, and all the bloodshed that has gone on for basic liberties, and yet the political people just walk all over it and are clueless, man. Clueless about how to handle what's happening. Now, that brings me to this whole idea of perfection. And I want to raise an issue. Okay, I want to raise this issue with you. And this comes up in the book of Hebrews. This is Hebrews chapter 12. And you could look it up with me. I think it's good to read around this a little bit. I generally like to put some Greek text around the authorized version because I want to see some of the exactitudes that you can find in the Greek text, and it helps us to see what the author intended. So if you have a look at Hebrews chapter 12, Hebrews 12 is interesting where it's placed. It's very interesting exactly where it comes, because if you look at the previous chapter, this is a chapter about various individuals' examples of faith. And these people are human beings. They're sinners, and they've got imperfections in their lives. There's no doubt. In fact, if you take just about any one of these people that are mentioned, you go back into the accounts in Genesis, etc., through the Bible, and you look at these individuals, they are not perfect. They are not. But when you find their examples of faith, there's nothing wrong here. It's a beautiful account of perfection going on here. Then when you get to chapter 12, with that in mind, it starts off in verse 1, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses. Yes, it's a great cloud of witnesses that we read about in chapter 11. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. So there is a race, and this is how Philippians and Hebrews very much lines up together, because it's about running this race. And then it goes on, and there's in verse 2 it says, looking unto Jesus. So we have the examples of human beings who were sinners and had imperfections in their lives, yet in Hebrews chapter 11 they are counted and shown only their perfect qualities. Then in chapter 12 we now got this example of Jesus. So if we have these examples of human beings who certainly had frailties and they failed in some circumstances, yet presented in this perfect light, then we have Jesus coming right after that. Do you think it would be in any way appropriate to believe that Jesus would not be a great example of running the race and going on unto perfection. Would it be possible in any sense to think that now Jesus could be an example of not going on unto perfection, not being an example to follow? It would be horrendous, would it not? It would be atrocious. It would go against everything we understand about Jesus. No, Jesus is set forth now as the author and the perfecter, the finisher, the one telos. The word comes from the word telos, coming all the way to the end, starting something and then going all the way to the end. And this is some of the ideas that we as Christians, we come to appreciate. As parents, don't you have this saying, don't you tell your children, when you start something, you finish it. Right? You start it and you finish it. Don't do half the lawn and then walk away. You start that lawn, you finish it. It comes through in our culture as Christians. Jesus, what he began, he took all the way, and he is the ultimate example of going on and completing the job. Right? I don't need to preach this thing through. I'm sure this is something you already definitely appreciate. In the book of Isaiah, you have this statement concerning the Messiah: "For the Lord God will help me, therefore shall I not be confounded. Therefore have I set my face like a flint, and I know that I shall not be ashamed." Set my face as a flint, man. It's not movable. There will be oppositions. There will be difficulties. And you know, it's hard to understand, isn't it, that the God who created all things would love the creation so much, meaning the creation, the person of human beings, that he would take on flesh. And this idea that God would come in the flesh is a hard thing to comprehend in its totality. That God in the flesh would be amongst men. That's a very hard thing to appreciate completely. What is understanding? You think about understanding. Understanding has to do with a lot of very complicated ideas. Because when we say that we understand something, whatever it is, I don't care what it is, anything, what do you really mean that you understand that? If I was to probe you, I can almost guarantee you with 100% certainty, and the only exception to this and could possibly be mathematics, but I don't believe that even in that case it's true, because of the philosophical part to mathematics also. But if you were to look at anything, if I was to ask you why, you've had this with kids, right? Kids are good at this, man. You tell them, this is what happens, and then they say, why? And then you say, well, because the steam comes down the tube and turns the turbine because it's got pressure on one side and it's got low pressure on the other. And then they say, why? And then you get down to the reality, and the reality is because that's the way it is. Right? Now, so who does understand everything? Well, it's certainly not us. It's God, right? There's an interesting passage where Paul talks a bit about this for people of another hope. When they will know even as they are known. They shall know even as they are known, which is a great bump in knowledge. But we don't really understand anything in its totality. But understanding has to do with connections. What can you connect these ideas with? And that goes out laterally and it goes down in depth. There is a hierarchical structure to things that we must know in order to have a full understanding of something. And everything connects to everything else. Everything does. It may not connect much, but it does connect. When I breathe my breath out into this audience, I hate to say this, friends, but you're going to be breathing some of the same air that I've just breathed out. And eventually that air will go around the country and then finally around the world, and everybody will be breathing my breath. Poor things, because I like garlic. My wife is a Persian, and they love garlic. Garlic is a big thing. Well, let me not get off on the garlic, because, man, have I had some experiences with garlic. Well, I want to bring your attention now to this passage, which is in Matthew. Okay? How we understand things is really important, because at some stage, there may need to be a complete overhaul of what you think you understand. Have you had that experience? I believe things were this way, and then all of a sudden, wham, you've got to completely change what you believed. That happened to me. That has happened to me in terms of the Bible. You know, complete change. Not an assimilation of an idea to my schema. That and the schema would be that idea of all these things that are interconnecting and there's depth and there's width. That's my schema, and I learn something else and I say, I see, that fits in there, that goes there. Yes, my existing schema, it works. I pull that idea and it fits in. But then all of a sudden, I come across something and I say, no, it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit anywhere in my current understanding. And what have I got to do? I've got to do something that's really hard, man. I've got to build a new schema. I've got to build something new. I've got to understand this in a completely new way. A readjustment has to occur, man. Readjustment is needed. Now, the ignorance concerning the history of how this country was founded has got to such a shocking state that for many people, many American children, they need a readjustment. They need a readjustment. Now, this story here is striking, right? Because of how this is interpreted. And I understand why the interpretation goes this way. But in fact, I think you will agree that the result of this is shocking. Really, when we understand what I've just said about Jesus being the author and the finisher, the one who is the perfecter, and the one who is the example of not drawing back. So this is Matthew chapter 26 and verse 36. Then cometh Jesus with them unto a place called Gethsemane. Gethsemane. And Gethsemane means the oil press. The oil press. And it goes on and says this, and saith unto the disciples, sit ye here while I go and pray yonder. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be sorrowful and very heavy. Then saith he unto them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death. Tarry ye here and watch with me. Even unto death. Even unto death. That's an interesting thing that he said there. Great sorrow is coming upon the Lord. Even unto death. And perhaps what we would perhaps imagine would be, well, he's facing down this cross which is coming upon him, right? And this is the death that he's thinking about. And it goes on, and it says, tarry here and watch with me. And he went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, oh, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. Not as I will, but as thou wilt. Now, what was his will? What was the Lord's will? Was the Lord's will that he did not die? You see, the way, if you look up many commentaries on this particular passage, what they'll say is, the Lord drew back. As a human being, he could not face the awfulness of what was about to happen, and he drew back. And could not do the Father's will, or did not want to do the Father's will, and they explain it by saying, well, he was a human. And God. Right? Now, if you want to check me out, do it. Go to the commentaries. Check out what's said about this. Essentially, you can say it any way you want, but essentially what they say is, he drew back. He drew back. Is this the author and the perfecter of our faith? Is this the example of going on unto perfection? Well, if that's the interpretation, I'd say no, this is not the example of going on unto perfection. Right? If that interpretation is correct. You say, well, what could be the interpretation? Well, let's just hold on just a little bit here. Let's just back up some of the ideas that I'm trying to convey to you. This is John 18:11. It says, Then said Jesus unto Peter, put up thy sword into the sheath, the cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it? Shall I not drink it? Peter's trying to stop this event from going on to its completion, right? And the Lord's saying, shall I not drink it? Well, just before I move on to something else, I just want to take this a little bit further. Just have a look back at Hebrews. And there are many, many passages that we could go to back this up, but I will just point out a few. Look at Hebrews chapter number 5. Verse 6. Hebrews 5, verse 6. As he saith also in another place, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And it says in verse 7, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers, in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications, with strong crying and tears. Where is this? This is Gethsemane. Unto him that was able to save him from death. Save him from death. Look at it. And was heard. He was saved from death. Wasn't he? Just read it. Look what it says. It says, unto him that was able to save him from death and was heard in that he feared, that is, he had piety. In that, in his pious beauty of his prayer, he was heard of the Father, and the Father answered that prayer, and he was saved from death. Now, just as a sidelight to this, if you've been on the internet and you've gone to Pal Talk, I did this many years. I haven't been on Pal Talk for a long time, but when I did many years ago, there would be Muslims busting into Christian rooms and doing their Islamic garbage and stuff, trying to disrupt things. But one of the verses that they would want to bring to you to try and teach their ridiculous Islamic doctrine that Jesus did not go to the cross is this one right here, right? And Christians, by and large, cannot answer it. Because they believe that this verse here somehow does relate to the cross. But what would the Islamic do? Well, he'd come in and say, Allahu Akbar! And then he'd go, see here, look. He prayed that he would not die, and the Father heard him, so he didn't die on the cross like you Christians believe. Right? That's how they spin that one. But what is the actual answer? Well, the answer is Gethsemane, the oil press. That is where Satan tried to stop this whole process from going forward and try to kill him in the garden, right there. Death was on him, big time. His body was weak. He died through weakness. He could hardly even carry the cross. And when Pilate sent out his centurion emissary to check on him, the centurion came back and said, he's dead already. And Pilate marveled that he was dead already. Why? Such was the attack on him. He sweat, as it were, great sweat of blood, drops of blood. Great pressure was coming on the Lord. And he nearly, or could have, died there. And the cup there was the possibility that it would be the Father's will that he would die there. See, he says, yet not my will, right, but thine be done. My will is that I go all the way to the cross. But if it's your will, Father, that I die right here, I will submit to your will. It's not my will. My will is to go all the way. And he did. Right? He did not draw back. And those commentaries that say that Jesus did draw back, they are pointing a finger at our perfect example of Jesus going all the way. You got the point I'm making? Now, I think this is an example of an error that's taught within Christianity. It's very common. It is an error, I believe, totally an error. It has consequences because you begin to doubt the veracity of the Scripture because there's contradictions if you believe the common conception. It's complicated. It makes things very complicated to believe that somehow Jesus is God in the flesh and he's not really acting very godly at some places. You know, you get that complication going on. Whereas the interpretation of simply putting things into their context and believing the Scriptures brings light. Light can come in that way. Light can come by believing the Scriptures and going here a little and there a little, right? And being careful, right? That's certainly true, as the prophet said. Okay, and I want to just take this idea a little bit further, okay? And this is a well-trodden, oh man, my heart, because I've been looking at this the previous week and I thought, well, now what should I bring to the truth for today, people, that would help? So, these were the passages. So all yesterday, what did we hear? Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4. And it's getting, you know, hammered. It's getting hammered. But nonetheless, we can put it in a slightly different context and perhaps we can get something from this that you didn't get previously. So this is Ephesians chapter 4. And let's just go there. And by the way, I haven't finished building on this business about Jesus being the author and the finisher. There's more to this, right? But for now, we'll stop there and we'll go to Ephesians. Because I think that's a tremendous idea. And as an educator, as someone that's interested in getting people to understand right the vision, I think this is critical. This is critical. That there are two ideas. There is this idea that sometimes you assimilate an idea to an existing schema. And then the other times, you've got to smash this thing and start again. Ephesians 4 starts off verse 1, I therefore the prisoner of the Lord. Isn't it interesting? This is brought out a lot by Charles Welch. When you compare chapter 3 verse 1 and 4:1, notice the difference here. In chapter 3 verse 1, for this cause I Paul the prisoner of Jesus Christ for you Gentiles. Jesus Christ for you Gentiles. Verse 1 of chapter 4, I therefore the prisoner of the Lord. Ah, big time. Lord, emphasizing the one who is the master, meaning that we are the ones who should be obedient. Chapter 4, 5, and 6, these are the chapters that have to do with deportment, how we should live, practically speaking. And there's, of course, big doctrine about that. And isn't it interesting, in that chapter, which has to do with our practical living, it says, verse 5, one Lord, one faith, one baptism. Isn't it interesting that the issue of the one baptism comes up in this very practical deportment area. And this is something that our Baptist friends would have some problems. They really understand this. In a practical sense, we must keep the unity which has already been made. We are keepers, right? We are the keepers. We don't make it, we keep it. They keep the peace, man. So it goes on. One Lord, one faith, one baptism. Not two, not three, not four. One. One baptism. And it goes down a little bit further in verse 7. It says, but unto every one of us is given grace according to the measure. Oh, here's this nice mathematical idea, this measure, this metron of the gift of Christ. Gift of Christ. And it says, wherefore he saith, when he ascended up on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men. Oh, wait. What is he doing quoting from the book of Psalms? Why is it that the one who brings us the distinctive ideas of how we are to live in this age, and then he quotes an Old Testament passage? Why would he do such a thing? And you notice in verses 9 and 10, there's this parenthetical thought here, now that he ascended. What is it? But he also descended first into the lower parts of the earth. He that descended is the same also that ascended up far above all heavens, that he might fill all things. And here is the hint in the parenthesis. Why would he do this? Because he's quoting from Psalm 68. And this psalm is very much in context for what he's talking about. Let's have a look at it. How am I doing for time? Oh, man. Yeah, okay, sorry about this. I'm a bit verbose here. I need to cut it down a bit. So Psalm 68. And here we got 35 verses. But down in verse 18 is where the quote comes from. Right? Thou hast ascended on high. Thou hast led captivity captive. Which really means that captivity has been made free, because the freedom is being made captive to God. There's freedom here. But the expression is beautiful. Captivity captive. If you look at verse 15, it says, the hill of God is the hill of Bashan, and high hill is the hill of Bashan. Why leap ye high hills? This is the hill which God desireth to dwell in. Yea, the Lord will dwell in it forever. This has to do with his temple, this high hill. And if you read in verse 18, it goes, look at verse 17. The chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of angels. The Lord is among them, as in Sinai, in the holy place. And then verse 18, it says, thou hast ascended on high, thou hast led captivity captive, thou hast received gifts for men, yea, for the rebellious also. Oh, this also involves the rebellious ones, that the Lord God might dwell among them. That's his goal. And then as you go down further, and you just read, let's go down, verse 32. Sing unto God, ye kingdoms of the earth. Oh, sing praises unto the Lord, Selah. Pause and consider. To him that rideth upon the heavens of heavens. Whoa! The super celestial man. And it goes on, which were of old, though he doth send out his voice, and that a mighty voice. Going back to Ephesians 4, can you see here that it makes perfect sense then that he would be quoting this passage, which relates to God's will, that he would dwell with man, that he would dwell in this holy place, and that his voice is now coming from the heavens of heavens. And then down in verse 11 it says, and this is chapter 4, verse 11 of Ephesians, and he gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers. Well, what do you mean he gave? Look at verse 8. It says, and gave gifts unto men. There's gifts previously of grace, we understand that, but now he's talking specifically about special gifts unto men. And he says in verse 11, and he gave, resuming what he began talking about. Parenthetical thought, then a resumption of what he'd started. He says, and he gave some apostles, these are the gifts, and some prophets, and some evangelists, and some pastors, and teachers. And the construction here, where it says pastors and teachers, means the same group. Pastors and teachers. These are gifts. One is foundational and died out. And we talked about that in the question session. Okay? They died out. But then what remains is pastors and teachers. How important are pastors and teachers? Well, they're gifts. You say, do you have gifts today? Are there gifts today? Do we have gifts today? Yeah, we do. We have gifts. They're pastors and teachers. And some feign being pastors and teachers, right? But the real ones, they are the gifts. And it says, what's their job? For the perfecting of the saints. And here comes the special word. It's not the word which means what you begin, you take to an end. No, no. This means readjustment. This means amending. The same word in its verbal form is used of mending a net, as is used in the scriptures. And the verbal form is found here. I haven't got time to go through them all. Here's one about the nets. It says about here in 1 Thessalonians, might perfect that which is lacking. There's something lacking. Yeah, something lacking. And then there is a filling up of that which is lacking, right? Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. Through faith we understand that the ages were framed by the word of God. Oh, what do you mean? Through faith we understand that the words were framed. Yeah. You see, there was a readjustment of the ages. And in that context then, there would necessarily mean that there was a mending of the ages. And therefore we can expect with the ages that the ages will end with some kind of damage that's occurred, and then the beginning would start of another age where there was some kind of repair. Okay, we can find that in the ages. So coming across now, let's go back to Ephesians, because I'm out of time, so I want to, you know, give you your money's worth. Ephesians 4. Oh dear.
Finish it.
There you go. So here, Ephesians chapter 4, it says this. Verse 12, for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the building up of the body of Christ, till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a perfect man. And the word from which comes this perfect man is the word that derives from telos, as in a telephone, telegraph, television, vision from a distance. It starts here, over here, and perfects, comes to the end, and we view it on our screen or whatever it is. Telephone, phone, voice. Starts over here, goes through a distance, and we say hello. I used to have a landline, and all I'd get is these garbage calls all the time, you know. Hello. Voice at a distance, and usually a robot. Telos. So here, what do we have? We have at the beginning a readjustment, right? That's the first kind of perfection. You've got to have the readjustment. And then on the basis of that readjustment, then you can be taken on unto the perfect female? No. Perfect bride? No. Perfect wife? No. Perfect man. And here, the man here is this, in its genitive, an heir, which is used, for example, as a husband, male. The metaphor here has changed. It is not a perfection out of an evolution from the acts which would occur without a readjustment. What are Christians doing today? Let's take the mid-acts brethren. What are they trying to do today? They are trying to perfect themselves without a readjustment. Right? They're taking doctrine out of the book of Acts, which were appropriate to a certain group of people whose hope was the hope of Israel, and they are trying to perfect themselves on that. That's what I tried to do. I tried to do that. You know, I've been through it, man. Starting off at Acts 2. Acts 2. Then mid-Acts. Didn't even know what part of Acts. Just call it mid-Acts. And then, finally, genius, Acts 28. After much pain and suffering, I tried to perfect myself without being readjusted. And yet, the gifts that are given to us are pastors and teachers whose job is for the readjustment of the most holy. And that's another topic. Right? But you can see the point, right? The point that's being made is that this kind of teaching is the full-on teaching. There has to be a readjustment. You can't come to this with your existing schema. You can't come as a Christian with your existing schema if it's coming out of the book of Acts. You've got to start with a new schema, man. There's got to be a readjustment. And face it. Face it front on and say, hey, I'm wrong. I've got to get this readjustment. And then I can take this perfection. I can go on unto perfection, unto this new hope associated with a new creation. Not an evolution out of the book of Acts, you know. Once I began to begin, you know. Some sort of monkey man. We can have some fun with this, man. But a new creation doth not yet appear what we shall be. But when he shall appear, we know that we shall be like him. And so it is true for our hope too. This brings up another doctrine about this. Of course, we each one are trying our best to run the race and to attain to some rewards too. Right? We won't all get the same reward. And how that would be manifested is a very interesting topic, which has to do with God's placement of people within his kingdom. And we will no doubt be given bodies suited for the place that he will put us. And that'll be an amazing thing. Now, if you want to know something, okay, that's the end of my talk, but if you want to know some of the wild things that I believe, you see, I believe that there are an infinite number of dimensions, in reality, truthfully, that there are. And that we are confined to the three spatial dimensions and the one of time. And that the other dimensions are zeroed out for us. But that God has an infinite number of dimensions that he's working on. And that his spatial coordinates that he has created, and he's outside of his creation, that he's working on all these things. When Jesus Christ ascended up into glory, what do you think he did? Do you think that he left the earth, went through the clouds, went past the moon, went past Mars, and then carried on? Is that what you think he did? Do you think that's how you're going to get into the super celestial area? I don't think so, man. I think that is just a visual thing for us mortals, right? So we say, yeah, he went up out of view, but what happened then? Dimension change, man. A dimension change, and into God's realm he went, right? Leaving the dimensions that we inhabit, and outside even the dimensions that he created, into the most holy place, which is where we will go. Now that blows your mind, man. And I love this particular talk because I think so much about my history and about what it means to educate people. It helps me understand that when you come to a person, they will have a schema, man. They will have a background. It's just different to you. And if you try and pick green fruit, man, you're wasting your time. You know? And you gotta just let it be sometimes. You come to someone, they don't want to receive this message. Okay. Okay? For now. The time will come when perhaps things will change. I mean, I've done all the mistakes, all of them. All of the mistakes that you can possibly make as a Christian, because I started off, as I said, in Acts 2, I went to a fundamental Baptist church, and by God, we're going to save this world, man. And we're going to bring them into this church, and we are going to baptize them, man. We're going to do this. And many of these people find Christians in many respects. But it ends up being trying to perfect things on the wrong foundation, trying to do things which are not right before God because there has not been this readjustment. Well, that's my talk to you today. Thank you.